from your point of view, but I personally prefer Srednicki's. Also, quantum field theory. And this one is also online. If you just Google Srednicki and quantum field theory, you should get a preprint. It's legal. There's a PDF you can find. Okay. So yesterday, we did the non-abelian Higgs mechanism. And we started off with a toy model. So we considered a toy model, and there was some controversy about how that worked. And so I want to just clarify a couple quick things. So we looked at a model that has nothing to do with nature. It was just an SU2 gauge theory with a fundamental scalar, scalar doublet phi. And we expanded this theory about the minimum, where we said that phi was 1 over root 2, 0, v phi plus some actual real field that has 0 at minimum at 0. We're just shifting it by its vacuum expectation value. And because this is SU2 symmetry, the covariant derivative acting on this is going to be del mu minus ig, that's the gauge coupling for SU2. Times sigma a over 2. So these are the Pauli matrices, the generators of SU2. We would call these tau a. And the gauge boson masses came from the term where, well, the kinetic term for the scalar doublet contains the, when we expand about the minimum, it's going to contain pieces that are bilinear in the VeV and in the gauge boson fields. So we're going to have terms that look like the following. I should remind us that this is V phi. It won't be the phi that we see in the standard model. It's just some other field. And then gauge boson bilinear that's contracted in a way that's suggestive of a mass. And we can use the identity. So there was controversy about this, but the identity is correct, that the anti-commutator of the commutators of SU2 can be rewritten in terms of the Kronecker delta. And the product in here can be rewritten as 1 half times the anti-commutator plus the regular commutator. And the regular commutator is just defined by SU2. But you can verify that this is actually equal to I epsilon ABC tau C, and that this is 1 half delta AB. Pardon? Tau A, tau B? Oh, yes. Good. Tau A, tau B. And so there's a symmetric part, there's an anti-symmetric part, and so this pops out. This is anti-symmetric. So if it's anti-symmetric and contracted into this, so, well, it gives zero once we contract something symmetric into something anti-symmetric. And so the gauge bosons get diagonal masses, I should just say. They come from the replacement where now I'm just pulling out factors of 2. There's going to be v squared, g squared, 0v, delta ab. Well, I shouldn't actually need to write that out. Just a reminder that this is now going to look like a bunch of a's. So this is a mass term. And in this theory, we would say that each of the m's is gv over 2. They're all the same, and nothing left over. So nothing is left massless. So this doesn't describe nature. So then yesterday we said, okay, let's generalize, or let's just expand the theory. So we're taking the group now to be SU2 left cross U1 right. All right, so you want hypercharge. I should be careful how I say these things. And we added a Higgs doublet with charge under the U1, YH equal to plus 1/2. We found that the covariant derivative acting on H in this theory is del mu identity matrix engage space. So this is 2 by 2. It's acting on the two components of this doublet. There was a gauge coupling for SU2 times the gauge bosons, which we can call X. I'll just give them a different name to remind you that this is a different theory. And the G prime, I should write the Y here first, times B mu times the identity matrix acting on H plus H0, which are the two different components of the doublet. These get shuffled into each other under gauge transformations of SU2 and U1, well, not the U1, but the SU2 shuffles them amongst each other. And we can choose a gauge where H is just written in terms of what lives downstairs. So there's V and little h. The factor of 1 over root 2 is to give the real field canonical normalization after we've expanded around the minimum. And we found that the gauge boson masses can be obtained just by considering the bilinear involving these gauge boson fields once we square d mu h in the same way that we did earlier, where now the 1/2 still comes from this factor of 1 over root 2. There's a 0 v. Now the situation's just a little more elaborate, so there are xa's sigma a over 2. There is a g prime y Higgs b mu times the identity. This matrix is squared. I don't have to worry about conjugation because all of these things are Hermitian. There was a factor of I that came from the definition of the covariant derivative, and then there was a factor of minus I that came from taking the Hermitian conjugate to construct this object. And so I know that this is now just this nice real symmetric thing once I've multiplied it out. I multiply by 0 v. There are other terms that I'm not going to be concerned with. And we expand this in a convenient way. So what we said was that this could now be written. So we use the usual definitions of the Pauli matrices, dot each of these generators into the appropriate matrix, add it all up. And what we found was that this gave us G prime B plus GX3. There is G prime B minus GX3. I'm suppressing the gauge index, or sorry, the Lorentz index. There's X1 minus IX2, and then there was GX1 plus IX2. This matrix was squared, so in matrix multiplication sense. And what we found was that there was a factor of 1 over 8 times v squared times g squared times x1 plus ix2 x1 minus ix2 squared. And then there was g prime b minus gx3 quantity squared. And this defined a set of massive gauge fields. So this defines a W plus minus mu, which I can call XI mu. Now I'm restoring the Lorentz index, but it's been there all along. X2 mu. There's a factor of I that I dropped yesterday. I'm sure everyone noticed. And then there's a Z boson, which goes as g prime b mu minus plus gx3 mu over the square root of g squared plus g prime squared. There was also a massless photon, which is the orthogonal linear combination. So there's g prime x 3 mu. The gauge couplings that multiply each of these things is different here, reflecting the fact that we're performing a rotation of these fields to diagonalize this term. So there's g b mu over the square root of the same thing. And the mass for the w was gv over 2. Mass for the z is v over 2 square root g squared plus g prime squared. And the mass of the photon is 0. Okay. We defined the electric charge to be g g prime over the square root of g squared plus g prime squared, and the cosine of the weak mixing angle to be g over the square root of g squared plus g prime squared. These are just definitions, but they're convenient given the form of these objects. And if we solve for b and for x3 in terms of z and a mu, when you insert them back into here, it's clear that you just get a diagonal mass term. For the w, it's clear already because this is the expression that shows up here and here. This is just w minus, and this is w plus. So there's an opposite sign convention. So the w with the plus gets the minus sign in between these two objects, and vice versa. This is the only place in this whole lecture where that's going to be true. Every other place is going to have the opposite convention, so just keep that in mind. So after we wrote that down, we had a second look at the covariant derivative. So a covariant derivative, this is the generic case, acting on any field that carries charge under SU2 and under U1. So the covariant derivative looks like minus IG X mu sigma A over 2 minus IG prime times the charge of that field. Doesn't have to be the Higgs. It can be anything. B mu. Y charges in the charge under U1. Y, not under electromagnetism. And in terms of these fields, and in using these definitions, we can rewrite this as del mu minus I g over root 2 times w plus mu t plus, notice that these are the same, plus w minus mu t minus. So this was mixed up in the lecture yesterday, so check yesterday. Yesterday's notes. It's easy to mix these things up because t plus minus is defined as just the raising and lowering operator of Pauli matrices. And so here the convention is that whatever's on the right-hand side mirrors what's on the left-hand side, which is the opposite of what you have for the W's. And this is necessary to preserve charge, to conserve charge at every interaction vertex involving the W. And then we also had I times G. Well, we had I. I'll write it in this way first. I times the square root of G squared plus G prime squared times Z mu times G squared T3 minus G prime squared Y. And then we had g prime square root of g squared plus g prime squared times a mu times t3 plus y. And this was the full covariant derivative, which we rewrote in a slightly more suggestive way. So d mu minus I g square root 2 w plus w minus t minus. The z part, once we take the definition here to be q, t3 plus y, we want to swap everything that depends on g prime in favor of one of these mixing angles. And we want to swap everything that depends on y in favor of a charge, because charge is more intuitive. And once we've written it in this way, we never have to worry about any other way again. So we can write this as I g over cosine theta weak. The cosine is in the denominator. The rationale is the following. So if I take a g squared and I pull it out, after I've replaced y, so I can always write y as q minus t3, which means that when we rewrite this expression, this is going to be g squared t3 minus g prime squared times q minus t3. So now I can just group the t3s, and that's going to give g squared plus g prime squared t3 minus g prime squared q. And then there's a factor of square root of the ugly thing out front, but now there's the thing squared that's out front of it, which gives us the form of cosine theta w in the denominator. And now I can just leave the t3 all by itself and do something similar for the other piece involving the g prime squared times q. After we've rewritten it in this way, we put a q here. And finally, at the very end, we can say that there's another operator that looks like IEQ times A mu. And so this is the actual form that we'll want to use. Okay, so let's add some matter. By the way, are there any questions about this before I add anything else? No? Okay. So by matter, we just mean fermions. And this is where the earlier lecture on two-component notation will hopefully pay off. I hope that the notation, at least in two-component language, is simpler than what's presented in some of the textbooks. I find it more intuitive, but maybe you'll disagree. So we can start off by considering leptons only. So leptons only, we saw earlier that the leptons are the electron, the muon, and the tau, and their corresponding neutrino flavors, so nu e, nu mu, nu tau. We refer to these as the first generation, this is the second generation, and everything tau-like is the third generation. These are their flavors. It's a little more complicated with quarks, which is why I want to start with leptons, so they don't feel any QCD. So no QCD yet. But there are interactions between, say, electrons, W's, Higgs's, and so on. Not in this way, just to remind you that there are interactions like that. And I want to define a left-handed Weyl spinner. Left-handed only in the sense that this tells you how it transforms under the Lorentz group. So this all spinner indices undotted because it's left-handed. But if I put a dagger on it, all the indices are going to carry dots. And I want to define, so this is just its name, an object that I'll call E conjugate right. Now the C is also just part of its name. C just tells you, so it just reminds us that it's quantum numbers, that it's gauge quantum numbers are opposite. This doesn't tell you anything about how it transforms under the Lorentz group, which means that it's still a left-handed spinner. These are just parts of its name. And they'll become convenient when we put things in terms of Dirac spinners. This thing carries charge under SU2, so under SU2 left, it's a singlet. So it doesn't feel any SU2 left, so no W interactions. Its covariant derivative won't have anything involving the W because the W is purely an object that started life and ends life as part of SU2, just the first two generators in a linear combination. And it carries Y of E conjugate, right? So this is its hypercharge is -1/2. No, sorry, I screwed up the, I should just say it's +1. Yes?
So you're saying that you're going to be writing this as a left-handed?
This is a left, yeah.
So you're saying that's left-handed?
This is a left-handed spinner. The R is part of its name. It's very confusing.
So what's the, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's the benefit of writing everything in terms of left-handed spinners? Like, why not just keep it as right?
Well, because, well, I hope that'll become clear by the end of this lecture. Because what we want to, so the machinery of Dirac spinners is a lot friendlier in some sense. It's a lot easier to learn how to do calculations with Dirac spinners. The identities are friendlier. It's more widely known. All the textbooks use Dirac spinners. But the standard model is naturally a theory of chiral fermions. And if you have a theory of chiral fermions, and you can write it all in terms of one kind of chiral fermion and not the other kind, then you just pick one. But you have to remember that sometimes their gauge charges have to be the opposites of what they need to be. And so this is, unfortunately, the most convenient way of doing it. So I'll hope to make it clear. Please interrupt me. I know this is slippery. I've screwed it up a million times. So just interrupt me if anything's not clear. That's why I want to go through this little preamble. So this is just its name. This is a left-handed Weyl spinner. And the other benefit to doing it this way is that this is what the literature does. So I can punt on an actual explanation for why it's got to be that way. But just a reminder that, yeah, the R, because, well, I'll get to it. But let's just for now forget the name. This is just some field, and it's uncharged under SU2, and it carries hypercharge of +1. Okay? So we want to know how it couples to the Z and to the Higgs. So what are its interactions? Its interactions are going to come from a Lagrangian for E conjugate right. And E conjugate right. I'll write out all the spinner indices this time. I'll suppress them from here on out. I just want to reconnect with what we've done originally. So this now is a right-handed object because I've put a dagger on it, regardless of what its name says. So there's a dot on the spinner index. So this is a spinner index. There's the usual kinetic term. So this is just Pauli matrix acting on spinner indices. So it carries two spinner indices of its own. It always contracts a right-handed and a left-handed spinner. There's a covariant derivative that just multiplies through every spinner index. And there is E conjugate right with an alpha downstairs. All dotted indices contract from down to up, and all undotted indices contract from up to down. Here I can concentrate on the case where we have E conjugate right. They're going to be corresponding for fields for the mu and for the tau. But once the first generation's worked out, all the other ones are automatic. So what's the derivative acting on E conjugate right? So that's going to be del mu minus I g over square root 2 w plus t plus w minus t minus minus I g over cosine theta w. I want to just use this shorthand because it's really annoying to write out cosine. They show up all the time. So this will be the cosine of the weak mixing angle. And I'll use s theta w for the other one. So this is z mu t3 minus sine squared theta times its charge. And minus I e times its charge, which, well, I'll leave it as q for now, times a mu e conjugate right. Okay. Just want to match the brackets. Okay. So this is cosine theta w. This is sine squared theta w. We remember that q is t3 plus y. And in this case, q acting on e conjugate right is t3. E conjugate right, and this is 0 because it doesn't carry any charge under SU2. So any of the t's acting on this will give 0. And it's hypercharge. And this part is just plus 1 because that was the charge assignment that we gave. And so this simplifies. I want to use the square bracket. So del mu, and notice that the object inside the square brackets is not a matrix. It's just a number-like object, because this doesn't have two components. This is just, well, it has two spinner components, but in terms of SU2, the gauge symmetry of the standard model, it's only a one kind of object. Whereas, for example, if we involve SU2, these are actually Pauli matrices that are above and beyond the Pauli matrices that define the kinetic term that acts on the spinners. So this Pauli matrix, where you do write out these spinners, only knows about spinner indices, that it just sort of multiplies through everything that involves the gauge stuff. And it's slippery, so just keep that in mind, because a lot of things that are very different fundamentally might look very similar. So back to E conjugate right. So this is not an SU2 doublet. So this part acting on it also gives 0. And so we're left with only minus IG over cosine theta W times Z mu. The T3 part is out. There's going to be minus sine squared theta W times its charge, which is plus 1. And then it'll be minus IE A mu E conjugate right. Okay, so this is D mu E conjugate right. Is that clear? Okay. So now let's look at the kinetic term. And only for the purpose of this example, I'm going to keep the spinner indices too. Everything in this box is appropriate only to this part right here. And I've suppressed the index, but I could have written a spinner index down here, but nothing inside the square box cares about that spinner index. So the kinetic term looks like E conjugate right dagger alpha dot sigma bar mu alpha dot alpha d mu E conjugate right alpha. And recall that sigma mu bar is a 2x2 identity matrix times the Pauli vector with a minus sign. If there's no bar, there's no minus sign. Okay, so we can multiply this out. So the first part is just going to look like the covariant derivative of a Weyl spinner. There was a pun about that in the homework. Okay. Whoops. Okay, so I'm only going to, here I'm just keeping this term. Now I'm going to combine the signs here. So there's going to be a plus, but there's going to be a minus I. So actually, I'm just going to keep track. This is where I make mistakes. So don't take any of the actual accounting super seriously. But this gives a feel for what the actual structure is like. So there's an I and then a net factor of plus I. And so that's going to give me minus I. G sine squared theta W over cosine theta W. And it's going to be E conjugate right dagger alpha dot sigma mu alpha dot alpha contracted into Z mu times E conjugate right alpha. And then there's going to be the QED piece. So the QED piece is going to get a net plus sign because I'm going to hit a plus I with a minus I. So that's going to be plus E conjugate right dagger alpha dot sigma mu alpha dot alpha, contracted into the photon field, E conjugate right, alpha. So notice that all charge is conserved. So the kinetic term always conserves charge. It's just it just tells you how a particle propagates. So there's a field, and then its conjugate. That flips the quantum numbers, and so this is an invariant object. Same goes for this. Everything here conserves charge because there's a dagger for every time there's not a dagger for the fermion field. And the gauge bosons here are neutral. And so none of these terms can change the charge of any particle living inside of a Feynman diagram. Oh, crap. Nah, I shouldn't do that, should I? Okay, so now I'm going to add more stuff. So for E conjugate right, that's it. All right, so now let's add the rest of the first generation. So we already have E conjugate right. I'm going to define a field that I'll call L. And and L is new electron times E left for the electron. So this actually cares about SU2. So this is a doublet. So it's a fundamental representation of SU2 left with a hypercharge of L equal to -1/2. So sometimes when we talk about fields that have charges under both SU2 and Y, we'll say, okay, so this is a doublet of SU2 left, so that's just the number 2 here, and then the subscript will tell you what its charge under hypercharge is. Or the other convention that you might see in the literature is in the form of SU2 left, comma U1 hypercharge, where you would say that this object is a 2, comma -1/2. Okay. Recall that the Higgs started life as a doublet. So the Higgs doublet was H, and this was a 2, comma +1/2. Okay. So now I'm adding just another doublet. This doublet's a fermion, but gauge indices are totally separate from Lorentz indices. So I can make scalar doublets, I can make fermion doublets. These things don't matter, at least insofar as the gauge symmetry is concerned. And the gauge transformations don't care about your Lorentz indices. So for example, L, which is nu E left, these are both left-handed spinners. Both left-handed spinners, they're each two components. So this is two component, and this is two component. But this is not a Dirac spinner, because this thing feels gauge transformations. Gauge transformations mix the nu E and the E left. They only have different names because we know the gauge symmetry is broken. But seriously, if we wanted to write down the theory in the absence of spontaneous symmetry breaking, if the Higgs field were zero, then these two fields would just be related by a symmetry. There'd be no experiment that would tell you that one of them is special compared to the other one. But of course, we don't live in that vacuum. So under SU2 left transformations, L goes to e to the I alpha tau alpha times nu E left. So this is the first component. This is the second component of the thing that this matrix acts on. And under SU2 left, And under U1 hypercharge, L just goes into a phase of itself. So this is just some function that we choose. These are the generators of SU2. And under U1 hypercharge, the transformation needs to know that there's something that carries hypercharge here and some function beta of x, which we choose. But that multiplies both of these things in the same way, because this is just proportional to the identity matrix. This is just a phase. So now we can do the same kind of thing. So what's the covariant derivative? Actually, before I get to the covariant derivative, I just really want to hammer home the point that this is not a Dirac spinner. So under Lorentz transformations, so a Weyl fermion, if it's left-handed, transforms in the following way. So these are operator-valued objects. So there's some psi alpha. I'll call it chi alpha so that I don't confuse notation later. U lambda. So this is one left-handed object. And this transforms as some matrix of the Lorentz group in the representation appropriate to fermions. That depends on the lambda, the choice of Lorentz gamma matrix that's acting on four vectors, times chi beta of lambda inverse x. So that's space-time dependence. So for L, if you do the same thing, L U lambda, so this is going to be U inverse lambda acting on nu E left, times U lambda. So this object is just going to tell us that, so this is just going to be equal to M alpha beta nu E times its beta index. So now I'm restoring the spinner indices. M alpha beta times E left beta. So this would not be the transformation rule if we were acting on a Dirac spinner. Okay, so these things are really just two representations of the Lorentz group inserted into a representation of the gauge symmetry SU2 left. So questions about that? So the lepton doublet. These are going to be more elaborate because now SU2 left is not trivial. And for future convenience, let's just consider the W part of the covariant derivative. So the W part contains W plus mu T plus W mu minus T minus. These are just the raising and lowering operators. So T plus is 1/2 Pauli 1 plus I Pauli 2. Or it's going to be 1, 0, 0, 0 in SU2 left space. And similarly, T minus is going to be 1/2 sigma 1 minus I sigma 2. And that's going to be 0, 0. Wait, did I do this right? No, I definitely didn't do it right. 1, 0. I'm adding two things that only have off-diagonal entries. And this one is going to have an off-diagonal, but in the other place. And these are going to tell us how the W acts on the left-handed electron and on the neutrino. I don't want to call them those things just yet, because technically they're just living inside of some sort of object that's a doublet. And if the Higgs weren't playing a role, if we didn't secretly know that later on down the road we were going to combine them into a Dirac spinner that walks and talks like the electron of QED, we would never have chosen this notation. But for now, just think of them as crazy names for some other thing that's an SU2 left doublet. And the Lagrangian for the left-handed doublet is going to look like the following. So there's L dagger, sigma bar mu d mu L. So now I'm suppressing spinner indices, but they're exactly the same as they would be before. Okay, but they're still around. So this, when I act with the dagger, that's going to make the left-handed spinners into right-handed spinners, and it's also going to flip all the gauge charges. So what we're going to have is new dagger and E left dagger. It's also going to make this a column vector, or a column doublet. These are just the components of the doublet themselves. So sigma mu times d mu minus ig. Well, let me just remind us that there's an identity matrix here, which I'll sometimes forget to write. G root 2 w mu plus times 0, 1, 1, and the other zeros, plus w minus 0, 0, 1, 0. Then there's going to be I over g cosine theta weak times z mu t3 minus sine squared theta w q. And this is going to act, well, and there's the QED part. It's going to be acting on nu E and E left. Okay. So this is the whole thing, but we'll go through it step by step. So the simplest thing to do is just consider T3. So T3 acting on the doublet, L, is T3 acting on nu E times EL. And that's going to be plus 1/2. Remember, T3 just gives you the eigenvalue of each one of these things when you act on it with the third Pauli matrix with a normalization of 1/2. So that just tells you that you get a plus 1/2 if you're upstairs and a minus 1/2 if you're downstairs. If you act with Q, that's just going to be, well, Q on L is going to be T3 on L plus Y on L. And that's going to be plus 1/2 nu E minus 1/2 EL. So that's just this part plus minus 1/2 nu electron, and the hypercharge is going to be minus 1/2 E left. Okay. So that tells us that the electric charge of the upper component is 0 and of the lower component is minus 1. So this is the quantum number of the electron. So this is correct E minus charge. Correct E minus and new charges. So the neutrino is neutral. The electron carries charge minus 1. Notice that when we did the same sort of thing for E right conjugate, I don't remember where we did this. Did we do it up here? Yeah, but its charge is plus 1, which is really like the charge of a positron, because we defined it to be a conjugate. So it's got all the conjugate gauge quantum numbers of an electron, which means you think of what the quantum numbers of an electron are, and you flip them, and that tells you what the gauge charges of ECR are. But all the left-handed parts are going to have the intuitive charge assignments. So this part is just going to be minus I, well, all right, let me just best way to do this, because it's a long expression. Let me rewrite it in the following way, just for convenience. So nu dagger e sigma bar. So I'm multiplying this in, acting only on the spinner indices. So this doesn't know that this is a two-component doublet. This just sails straight inside. So e left dagger sigma mu. So this is a 2x2 matrix acting on a column spinner. And so now the covariant derivative will act on nu e E left. So this is going to get, once we dot this into that, we're going to get the usual kinetic term once the I is restored. So then we're going to get IG over square root of 2. When the W plus acts on this, this matrix is only going to keep it's only going to keep the lower component, where I just multiplied this by nu e and e left, and so it only kept this part. So that 2x2 matrix into a two-component doublet gives me just a two-component doublet. And something similar is going to happen with the w minus, only now it's going to lower. So this is a raising operator, so it killed the top guy, and it preserved the lower one. But I screwed this up, because really, this puts it upstairs, because it's a raising operator. Right. I'm just multiplying this into that matrix. This is a lowering operator, so this will give me new electron. Okay. And then we're going to have IG over cosine theta weak. Times z mu. So we know what the T3 acting on this is. We can just insert this blindly. 1/2 and minus 1/2 e left. We can then subtract off sine squared theta times the charge operator. So now the charge operator is just going to give us 0 and minus e left. Should make the minus sign prominent. And finally, it's going to do what we would expect it to do from QED. This is now going to become an I times minus. So the net effect is going to be a plus IE A mu times 0 E left. So questions about that? No? Okay. All right, so I'm not going to multiply it out just yet. I mean, it's trivial to do that. These are all just column spinners, they're all column doublets, and you can multiply them into this row, and then the interactions are the usual ones. So this will just give a normal neutrino and electron left kinetic term, and then there are going to be interactions that'll mix the W and the nus. So for example, for this term, we're going to get IG over root 2. It's going to combine a neutrino and an electron. So there's going to be an overall I and a minus I. So we can write nu E dagger. Sigma mu contracts with the W mu, the W plus, and we're going to get E left. And there's going to be the conjugated version of this term coming from this object, where it's going to be E left dagger sigma into W minus mu times nu electron. This is not the most convenient place to put it, but just to suggest how these things hook up. We're going to do the Feynman rules in four-component notation, because we'll ultimately want to do all of our calculations in terms of Dirac spinners, but this is where they come from. And in order to make contact with four-component notation, we're going to have to figure out how the Dirac spinners arise. So how okay, well, the answer is that we need to interact with the Higgs. Interact with the Higgs because all fermions are massless so far. And they must be. And they must be massless because we found that there were two options for a mass term, so for fermion masses. So you could have a Majorana mass term, which in two-component language means that you have a mass and you have some vial spinner, chi, and then you have its conjugated version. So this is a Majorana mass. There's a factor of 1/2 because here you're building a mass term out of the same spinner. So mass So this is a mass from the same spinner, but this is a problem for us. Problem because it's not gauge invariant. So this is not gauge invariant, and to see that, take any of the fields that we've introduced so far. So let's try. Let's try anyway. So let's do the simplest case, so E conjugate right. So this is just a standalone vial spinner. If I wanted to write down a mass term, I could say, all right, here's E conjugate right. I have to contract its spinner indices in the usual way. E conjugate right alpha, and then there would be E conjugate right dagger dot, E conjugate right dagger alpha dot. And now let's just perform a gauge transformation. So act with, say, U1 hypercharge. That's the only kind of charge that it knows about. So then I would be taking E conjugate right into some phase factor EY times beta of X times E conjugate right. And notice that this mass term literally has the same field here and the same field here. For two-component notation, this is a Lorentz invariant object. It's the simplest kind of mass term you can write down. And that means that under this operation, for the U1y, this mass term goes into e to the I 2y beta of x e conjugate right alpha e conjugate right alpha plus the Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so this is bad. This is not invariant. So this is not invariant and it's not allowed. So we have to do something else. So I don't really want to get rid of this. This is kind of a good thing to keep around. So what are the other options? Well, what do we have to play with? So far, we have a Higgs doublet, we have a lepton doublet, and we have E conjugate right. This thing carries charge 2 plus 1/2 under SU 2 left times U1 hypercharge. This thing carries, it's a doublet and it has hypercharge -1/2, and this thing is a singlet under SU2 left, and it carries hypercharge of plus 1. So how do we make a Lorentz invariant thing out of these three objects at renormalizable level? L Higgs. So we could write down an interaction. Well, before I write it down, let me just motivate it. So suppose I write down H times L. This isn't not Lorentz invariant. Invariant because we have a spinner and a scalar. Spinner plus a scalar, I have a dangling index. This is really, there's a spinner index that can't be contracted with anything that the Higgs has to offer. So this is bad news by itself. Suppose we do the following. So suppose I have H times L times E conjugate right. Does this work? So H is a doublet. I can contract two doublets with each other by using the epsilon tensor. So in an SU2 invariant way, with epsilon alpha beta, these are SU2 indices. They're fundamental indices. So maybe I shouldn't call them alpha beta. Maybe I should just call them ij. So these are the indices that act on the components of fundamental representations in SU2. SU2 is kind of special in this way. So if I have two doublets, I could just write down hi lj times epsilon ij. And this would be invariant under SU2, because when I act with an SU2 matrix on H, and then another one, well, I'd have to act with the same one because they're doublets. So it would have to be HKL acting on L sub L. Epsilon acts on the dangling indices, so it would be IK. Okay, so this is invariant because I can take these matrices, and when I act with the epsilon, that gives me a determinant. The determinant's invariant of SU2 matrices. So this is actually okay for SU2, but it's not okay for hypercharge. U1y, because if I perform U1y transformations, so the Higgs is going to go to e to the y Higgs times some function beta times Higgs. The lepton doublet is going to go into EYL times beta lepton. And E conjugate right is going to go into e to the IY E right times beta and itself. And these things don't add in the right way. I need to get all of their phase factors to cancel. So the combined effect of HL E conjugate right will be that we get E to the I Y Higgs is plus 1/2 times beta. Then there's going to be E to the I minus 1/2 times beta. So this is Y Higgs. This is Y left, or for Y for the lepton doublet. And then there's going to be e to the I plus 1 times beta e conjugate right. Okay, so these things clearly don't add because I have a plus 1/2, minus 1/2, and a plus 1. So this is not the same as HL e conjugate right. So this is also not allowed. So what can we do? And I'll be done in a moment, I swear. We could make H an anti-doublet. Ah, crap. we could just put a dagger on it. So I'm not changing anything that we know and love about the Higgs doublet. Just in this particular interaction, I'm just going to put a dagger on it. And so what we're going to have is H dagger times L times E conjugate right. Here I'm suppressing a lot of the spinner indices. So with all indices, what we really have is HI dagger times LI. So these are SU2 left fundamental indices. Okay, and they're contracted. So now, after I've put a conjugate on this, H dagger transforms as H dagger e to the minus I alpha A tau A under SU2. So I don't have to do anything funny in order to make a gauge invariant object. This thing just goes into the opposite of whatever the lepton doublet goes into. So this is manifestly invariant under SU2 left. And I can also just multiply on E conjugate right. Now I'm going to add an alpha. This is a spinner index. And I'll put a box around it, so just to remind us. So now this is invariant, so this makes it Lorentz invariant. So Lorentz invariant contraction. And the very last thing I'll just say is that when we expand this around the minimum, and I'll review it tomorrow, when we expand it, H dagger is going to look like 1 over root 2 0 V. So now it's a row. The V is real, so it doesn't care about the dagger. And so this whole thing is going to look like the square root of 2 times 0 V times new electron times E left. So this is the left-handed doublet. And I'm treating this contraction of I and I as just a row column and a row times a column of SU2. There are alphas for the spinner indices, E conjugate right times a spinner index. And this is going to give us something that looks like V over root 2 times E left alpha E conjugate right alpha. I should get that. Okay, so this will give us a mass for the fermions. For electrons, not neutrinos. And this is some place to stop. I'll review all of this tomorrow, where we'll give it a little more careful treatment. But I just wanted to couple the SU2 sector to matter, and then turn on a Higgs interaction to give mass to the fermions. So are there any questions? Yeah?
The argument you made there was
Yeah.
That's exactly the same as the saying, like the interactions, like if you were to draw that vertex, you'd find charge.
Exactly. If you demand that U1 hypercharges conserve, that vertex would not respect that. Yeah.
Can you get something similar for the SU2, like the SU2 lack of invariance?
For this thing, no. No, because if you have two doublets, you can always make some kind of invariant under that. Those are simpler, even though they require more bells and whistles. All right, so then I guess tomorrow we'll rehash this argument, extend it to the higher generations, and if we have time, talk about how the quarks interact with the W's and the Z's. But I'll do a recap in case anything wasn't clear.
Does higher generations do anything other than just changing the labels?
They will when we deal with the Higgs, because they have to get different masses. Yeah. And they'll have different interactions with the W.